Last week on this program, we spoke to two Republicans who disagree on Libya. First, a veteran diplomat from the Bush administration, John Negroponte, who supports the military intervention.
We're creating this no-fly zone so that the situation can stabilize. The opposition has a chance to survive. The civilians aren't being slaughtered by Mr. Gaddafi. But the next phase is going to involve other types of action.
Another Bush administration veteran, Richard Haass, opposes what the president is doing.
I don't believe our interests there are close to being vital. I also don't think this is designed in a way that people have thought through what happens after the airstrikes.
People on the left are also divided. We'll talk next with Phyllis Bennis at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to our program.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you.
Also with us, Mark Lynch, who heads the Middle East Studies program at George Washington University and writes for Foreign Policy magazine. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Now, Mark, let's begin with you. After President Obama's speech on Libya, you wrote a piece defending him, saying he had to do it. Why?
Well, I think that what happened in between when this crisis broke out and when Obama and his NATO allies decided to act was that the military situation changed on the ground. And we were looking at tens of thousands of people being slaughtered while the world watched. The United States would have been blamed for it, and the United States should have been blamed for it.
Phyllis Bennis, what about you?
I have to disagree at the notion that our government, or any government, responds purely to humanitarian motives. The reality is, if we were so concerned about humanitarian motives, we would have done other non-military things, both in Libya and perhaps more significantly in places like Bahrain or Yemen, way before it ever got to this crisis.
Well, the United States has already put quite stringent sanctions on Libya. What else was there to do in Libya?
There was a lot to do. We can't forget that from 2003 until a month ago, Gaddafi was our guy. The U.S. had embraced him, not as much as the Europeans, but significantly. U.S. oil companies, as well as European oil companies, were right in there. So there were things that could and should have been done long ago, because repression in Libya is not a new phenomenon.
The president talked about this in two different ways. He talked about it as a humanitarian intervention, but he also talked about how the United States feels that it would be in its interest if Gaddafi were to step down. That's two different things. Are you at all concerned that we could be headed in a quagmire-ish direction?
Well, I'm very concerned about that. And I think that the weakest part of the administration's response has been trying to figure out what the end game's going to be. It's very difficult to imagine an acceptable outcome that involves Gaddafi staying in power, but for diplomatic reasons, they can't say so. I think that right now we have a great deal of Arab support and international legitimacy for what we're doing. But in my conversations with both Arab intellectual leaders and with Libyan opposition figures, American troops on the ground is absolutely unacceptable.
Do you think that anything that the president is talking about can actually be made to happen without troops, Phyllis Ennis?
I think that there is clearly a difference between having troops on the ground and having this kind of military engagement. But I think as far as people in Libya and in the Arab world and the rest of the world, the distinction is not all that great. What we're looking at is already mission creep. We first heard that this was going to be just a no-fly zone. Then it was a no-fly zone with airstrikes against imminent attacks on civilians. Now it's airstrikes in places like very distant military bases, airstrikes on barracks where there are Libyan troops not engaged in fighting. And in fact, we've seen what we saw in Iraq in 1991 that was called a turkey shoot, where retreating fighters and retreating tanks were attacked by French and U.S. warplanes.
Richard Haass, who's president of the Council on Foreign Relations, we heard from him earlier. He said on our program that he doesn't see any reason to be confident that the people who are opposing Mr. Gaddafi are people that we would be happy to see heading a government in Libya, that we don't really know who they are or what they stand for, and we might not like it if they succeed. Do you have that concern?
I think that like all of the other parts of the Arab Spring, this uprising is of a wide range of people across Libya. There are people there that I might like and people I don't like. But it's not my call. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't live in Libya. That's not my right to say who they are, who gets to take power. The difference is for the U.S. government or any other government to embrace these people and start fighting for them, then we need to be concerned whether it's al-Qaeda forces, whether it's former CIA-backed Contras, which is what we're now hearing are part of the new leadership of the opposition. All of those are of serious concern to the government.
Do you think that's a problem, Mark Lynch?
Well, anything could be a problem. But I think that Libya had become a litmus test for the Arab world. And people are watching very carefully to see what happens. Right now, that means that if the United States had stood by and let people be slaughtered in Benghazi, this would have been a horrible impact on America's standing in the region.
Where do you stand on the possibility that the United States and others will decide to start arming these rebels?
I think that the idea of us arming the rebels is a bad idea. We've been down that route before. It hasn't worked. On the other hand, what's really dangerous is where one side, in this case Gaddafi, is able to get access to weapons and his opponents are not. And so I think what we don't want to be doing is artificially preventing one side from getting what it needs. But I don't think we should be in the business of arming them.
Phyllis Bennis, what do you think about the possibility of arming the opposition?
It would give the U.S. way more power and influence in a post-Gaddafi Libya than it deserves.
Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Phyllis Bennis is with the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us in our studio along with Mark Lynch, who heads Middle East Studies at George Washington University.
And if that's the timeline we're looking at, 3 years or longer, what are the political implications? Well, that's where we'll start our weekly conversation with analysts E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and today Ramesh Panuru, senior editor of The National Review, sitting in for David Brooks. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we're looking at the fourth straight monthly drop in unemployment, now at 8.8%, a full percentage point down since November. Let's cast forward, Ramesh, to next year's presidential campaign. How does the economy play? Is this still the albatross for the president that Republicans would like to think it is?
Well, I think that the Republicans have a much easier time of it if unemployment isn't dropping because they can still make the argument that it hasn't dropped far enough, that this is not the new normal that Americans should accept. But it's a lot easier to say the administration's program's a complete failure and nothing's budging. These sorts of numbers make that harder.
Mm-hmm. E.J.?
Well, I think the theme song of this recovery is a long and winding road, or it's a long way to the top if you want full employment. I think these numbers are probably more helpful than not to the president because the private sector trend is pretty good. And if you could actually keep moving in this direction through the election year, even if unemployment were above 7%, if you get it down below 8, I think it helps him. But there's some really disturbing numbers underneath the good numbers. 6 million people have been unemployed for 27 months or more. It's the lowest labor participation rate in a quarter century. And local government jobs continue to go away. We lost another 15,000 in March. We've lost 416,000 of local government jobs since September 2008. It strikes me that it's a very, very strange time for Washington to be obsessed with cutting spending when it's state and local spending cuts that are holding this part of what are holding this recovery down.
Well, let's turn then to the budget wrangling in Congress. The temporary spending measure runs out 1 week from now, April 8th, and there are conservative Republicans saying, look, let the government shut down. Tea Party activists were here rallying on Capitol Hill yesterday with this chant.
Cut it or shut it! Cut it or shut it! Cut it or shut it!
Cut it or shut it. Ramesh Panuru, you say bring it on. Bring on a government shutdown. Why?
Well, I don't know if I would actually say bring on a government shutdown. I think, though, that one may be inevitable either this spring or in the fall because I do think that there is so much of an emotional desire on the part of conservative Republicans to have this sort of moment of grand confrontation where they really stick it to the spenders. I think that a shutdown is likely to happen sometime this year because it's the Democrats want it for strategic reasons and the Republicans want it for emotional reasons.
And you're saying better to have it now than in the fall?
Well, if you're going to have one, I would think that if you're John Boehner, who doesn't really want a shutdown, who thinks it's not in the party's political interest, but he's got to think if there's going to be one, better it be earlier with more time to recover than later. Better it be earlier where you've shown your troops you've really tried to go all out for them than have some situation where they're saying that you sold them out.
And do you think that Republicans would pay a price at the polls for that, as they did after the shutdown in 1995?
Well, there are some reasons for thinking that it wouldn't be as bad as 1995-96. For one thing, John Boehner just isn't the kind of polarizing and well-known figure that Newt Gingrich was at that time. But yes, I think that people do expect the government to function. And whenever there's a fight, the party that is more anti-government is going to be blamed for the shutdown of the government. It's just the natural place that people are going to go, and it's not going to matter what kind of spin Republicans put on it.
EJ, what do you think? Who gets blamed if the government shuts down?
I think right now the polls, there are some polls that show the Republicans get blamed. Others show that it's mixed. I think the difference from 95, and maybe he'll get around to doing it, but I don't think President Obama has set up this fight very well compared to the way Bill Clinton set up the fight. I mean, when Bill Clinton set up the fight as a fight over Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment. And those were all very popular causes, and he was blaming the Republicans for cutting those things. Right now, this debate is a debate over numbers, 33 billion, 61 billion. If it's a fight over numbers, the Republicans are going to win because they're always the people who are going to cut a bigger number. And right now, I think that if the Tea Party is really on dangerous ground, if it wants to do politics as theater, I don't understand, except for the psychological reasons that Ramesh pointed to, why they don't pocket a big victory here. Because Boehner and Speaker Boehner and Paul Ryan wanted to cut 30-some billion early on. The Tea Party pressured them into more. Now they can settle for what they were going to ask for in the first place. I used to think a government shutdown was very likely this week. I'm a little less so now because Boehner is showing signs of wanting to take that $33 billion and figure out how to buy off the Tea Party, maybe with the draconian Ryan budget that will come next week.
EJ, you've written this week that you would like to see President Obama apply the same principled thinking to the budget that you heard him apply in his speech on Monday on Libya. What did you hear in that speech that showed you that he had those principles?
Well, I thought that on the Libya speech, he told us why he did what he did. He explained the underlying principles behind it. I think he showed some real passion both for why there were moments when the U.S. really did have to stand up for its values, but also a really practical sense of why we couldn't always do it in exactly this way, why we needed to show restraint. You knew where he stood at the end of that, I think, whether you liked the speech or not. On the budget, there has been this very conscious disengagement because he doesn't seem to want himself to get mired in congressional politics. I get that up to a point. But in the end, budgets are moral documents, and there are some really bad things in this Republican budget that periodically he says he's against, cuts in Head Start, cuts in Pell Grants to help kids go to college. But he hasn't really put any passion into it or put out a consistent effort to explain.
Ramesh, on Libya, did you hear on Monday night a clear articulation of what we might call the Obama doctrine?
I don't think so. Unless the doctrine is not to have a doctrine. You know, the administration seems to pride itself on being sort of ad hoc, flexible, and not being dogmatic about these things. The most striking thing, I think, about the address on Libya was how late in the game it was. Normally one would think that such a presidential address would be given around the time that the bombs start flying. And I don't know whether it really was persuasive to people, partly because, you know, just the way things are, people pay a little bit less attention to each presidential address than they did to the one before. But also because I think for reasons of policy, the administration is holding back, the president is holding back some of its real thoughts about the subject. I don't think that this intervention makes sense unless an undeclared aim of the war is regime change, or at least regime modification, but he's not willing to say it.
Okay. Thanks to you both, and no fooling. Have a great weekend.
And you too. Thank you.
Ramesh Panuru, senior editor at the National Review, and E.J. Dionne, columnist with the Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
have more in a minute from All Things Considered.
Members of Congress are still fighting over cuts in this year's federal budget. Among the proposed trims are dozens of programs House Republicans want to eliminate completely. NPR's Julie Rovner looks at one of them, the federal family planning program known as Title X.
It's a typically busy Wednesday afternoon at the Unity Healthcare's Upper Cardozo Clinic. It's located in a heavily Hispanic neighborhood in northwest Washington, D.C.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Family physician Andrea Anderson is seeing a patient for a sinus problem. But as long as she's here, Anderson asks her if she's happy with the birth control method she's using. Thanks to the Title X program, Unity has available a wide array of contraceptive options. Anderson keeps a sample of each in a plastic Ziploc bag for easy demonstrations.
And I have in here a patch, which is what she ended up changing to.
Anderson says one of her favorite things about the family planning program is the way it lets her integrate contraceptive choices into her everyday practice.
Patients come in for a cold, they come in for their blood pressure check. We say, what type of family planning method are you using? You know, is that working well for you? Oh, do you need something different? Not just for women, but also for men as well, because the men are also part of the decision-making process.
Karen Klaus, a certified nurse midwife at Unity, says it works the other way, too. Sometimes the family planning program is the entry point for patients to get other health care services they might need.
They come in thinking that they need to get their pap smear or they're interested in a family planning method, but as soon as I see them, I see that their blood pressure is completely out of control. Or based on the family history that I've gathered, they're at really high risk for diabetes, and I check their blood sugar and it's sky high.
The Title X Family Planning Program was created in 1970, signed by President Richard Nixon and championed by then Congressman George H.W. Bush. Its goal was to provide low-cost family planning services. Abortion has been banned as an allowed service since the program began. But even so, Title X has long been entangled in abortion politics. Among the many reasons for that is that Planned Parenthood affiliates get about a quarter of all Title X dollars. Planned Parenthood clinics are also the nation's largest abortion providers, although they don't use federal funding for that. The controversy surrounding the program is a shame, says Dr. Mark Hathaway, Unity's Title X medical director. That's because of the roughly 6 million pregnancies in the U.S. every year, half are unintended.
And of that half of those end up as abortions. And that's a ridiculously, ridiculously high level of abortions in a country like ours where we have supposedly the best technologies and the best available methods to help women avoid pregnancy when they don't want to be pregnant.
And if reducing abortion is a goal, then getting rid of the Title X program is not the way to accomplish it, says Unity nurse midwife Karen Klaus.
If the Title X program goes away, there's no question that the unintended pregnancies would go up, and as a consequence of that, abortions across the country would go up.
Some religious conservatives oppose the entire idea of the government handing out contraceptives, particularly to people who aren't married. But others oppose the program for other reasons. Chuck Donovan is a senior research fellow with the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
At the end of the day, there's just a question of how many things can you afford, and is this one a national priority?
Donovan says Heritage isn't against contraception. He just thinks the program should be funded through people's individual insurance.
And then it would be a matter of the individuals deciding what their needs are and using their insurance dollars to purchase those services rather than all of the cost and bureaucracy of a federal program.
In the meantime, however, as more and more people are losing their health insurance, the demand for services under the Title X program has been rising. In 2009, the program served just over 5 million patients. If it actually is canceled, how those patients will get care remains a question yet to be addressed. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
You won't be needing that eye surgery to watch the new movie Source Code. It's not in 3D. Critic Kenneth Turan says it is part of a much narrower trend. Like the Adjustment Bureau a few weeks ago, it's a sci-fi romance.
Source Code is the science fiction thriller version of Groundhog Day. Really. It starts with Jake Gyllenhaal, groggy and haggard on a commuter train headed into Chicago. He thinks he's Air Force Captain Coulter Stevens, but the woman seated opposite him, played by Michelle Monaghan, thinks he's someone else.
How well do you know me? Not that well, apparently.
You know me well enough that if I did something that looked a little strange and was maybe even a little bit dangerous, but I told you to trust me anyway, that you could do that?
No.
It turns out that source code is the name for a mysterious process that allows Stevens to go back in time and assume another person's identity for the last 8 minutes of that man's life. He becomes a passenger on that train in order to find another passenger who's a mad bomber. The assignment leaves him understandably confused.
At 7:48 this morning, Central Standard Time, a bomb exploded on a commuter train outside of Chicago, killing everyone on board. And that's the train that you've been on.
No, I'm right here. You're talking to me right now.
A man named Sean Fentress was on that train. He, for all intents and purposes, is now you.
It may sound like a version of hell for moviegoers to have those 8 minutes on a train replayed over and over and over again, half a dozen times at least. But the film has come up with a surprising number of variations on that theme. Those repetitions add to the tension as we wonder what Stevens will do next and how that choice will play out. Gyllenhaal and Monahan go full out with this far-fetched premise, and if they didn't, this twisty film would be in big trouble. But when his passion is added to her flirtatious presence, science fiction romance is definitely in the air.
The movie is Source Code. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.
"3D is showing up everywhere, from the Cineplex to your living room. There's just one problem. Most of the technology still relies on those cumbersome 3D glasses. But as Jen Sands-Windsor reports, that problem may soon be a thing of the past."
"You're not in Kansas anymore. You're on Pandora."
This is Avatar, the most financially successful movie of all time. It launched the 3D craze.
"Well, I think it's pretty well established that 3D is the future."
That's Anderson Smith, entertainment expert with YHR Analysts.
"They're going to be 3D televisions, 3D billboards, 3D computers. The only thing standing in the way now is those ridiculous glasses."
San Diego ophthalmologist Dr. Sebastian Marsh says he has a solution.
"We've developed the first surgical procedure that lets people's eyes act like 3D glasses."
The operation is still considered experimental. One of the first patients, Rebecca Stern, says she's happy with the results so far.
"Seeing Romeo and Juliet without those horrible glasses was life-changing. There are no words to describe it."
There are still some kinks to work out.
"Some patients have complained of blurred vision when they are not looking at 3D screens. So we're actually working now on some special corrective lenses that will allow our patients to see real life normally."
Stern says it's worth it for the convenience. She won't need to wear glasses in her living room when her 3D TV arrives. For NPR News, I'm Jen Sands-Windsor in San Diego.
Dr. Marsh and his team hope for a wider release of the procedure in select cities starting April 1st, 2012.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we begin the program by talking about two reports that tackle the issue of race in this country. In a few minutes, we will hear from Shirley Sherrod for a discussion about bridging our racial divisions. She wrote the foreword to one report, a collection of essays. Shirley Sherrod, of course, is the former USDA official who was fired after her remarks and career were misrepresented by a conservative blogger. But first, we hear from the leader of one of this country's leading civil rights organizations about his group's new report, an annual one that assesses how African Americans are faring compared to whites on key measures such as health and economic opportunity. It's called The State of Black America. It is published by the National Urban League, and the president and CEO of the group, Mark Morial, is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Good day. Thank you for having me.
Now, this report has been published annually since 1976. So for those who are not familiar with it, what do you try to capture in this report?
We try to capture the condition of Black America and comparison to the condition of white America, and we try to make commentary on issues of importance to the nation.
What's the headline for this year's report? The
headline this year is jobs, 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 that the high unemployment, which is a result of the Great Recession, is the biggest challenge facing the nation and the biggest challenge facing Black America. The joblessness rate in Black America is almost 16%. It's twice as high as the overall rate. That means the rates are very high in urban communities across the nation. So it's about the problem, but it's also about solutions. It's about policy solutions, but it's also about examples of people who are fighting to overcome the odds in these difficult times.
You know, the report makes clear that over the lifetime of this report, as we mentioned, this has been an annual report that's been published since 1976, there has been growing equality between blacks and whites in the unemployment rate, the percentage of uninsured, the incarceration rate, and prisoners as a percentage of arrests. On the other hand, you said there's been growing inequality in the poverty rate, the home ownership rate, and educational attainment and school enrollments rates. Why do you think that is?
I think African Americans are like a caboose on a train, and when the train speeds up, African Americans speed up but still remain in the caboose. When the train slows down, the caboose slows down, but the caboose is still the caboose. And I think that no doubt that the economy, which now requires higher levels of educational attainment, better skills, it makes it difficult when you've got lower high school graduation rates. So long term, fixing the problem of education is going to be key. But in the short run, we need targeted economic policies. We need to understand that there are 474 counties in this nation where the poverty rate is higher than 20%. This issue goes beyond what people may think of in a traditional sense. We want to shed light on that. And we want to shed light on the fact that a report includes 12 ideas for job creation. Some ideas like summer jobs that we've championed for a long time. Some ideas like green empowerment zones that are sort of a new idea. We want to showcase those ideas.
Is there any appetite for, as you call it, targeted efforts in this economic climate?
I think that there's beginning to be a bigger appetite from some. Congressman James Clyburn talked about targeted initiatives he's working on to us yesterday. President Obama has, in fact, included in his 2012 budget a proposal for growth zones. We think there needs to be a more vigorous appetite. We think if people understood that the bigger the headache, the bigger the pill, meaning the larger dose of medicine is needed in those areas where the unemployment rate is higher, more targeted job training, more of an effort to create incentives for businesses to locate in areas where the unemployment rate is high, it'll be good for the country at large. I think there's been somewhat of a reluctance to do that. I don't understand it, but the Urban League's voice is going to continue to say we need targeted economic policy.
And finally, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about your prior life as the mayor of New Orleans. There's new census figures just out that show that a number of major urban centers that had previously been, you know, supermajority African-American populations are losing African-American population. New Orleans lost about 7% of its black population since the last census. According to these new figures, it dipped from about 67% African-American to 60% African-American. Similar stories are playing out in places like Washington, D.C., Detroit. And I'm just curious, with your perspective as both the former mayor and as the leader of a national civil rights organization, what does this mean, you think, for continuing conversations around civil rights?
I think what we need to understand is that those folks went somewhere. In the case of New Orleans, there's the Katrina effect, which means that people are now in places like Baton Rouge and Houston. What you've seen is as black populations in cities has declined, black populations in suburbs has increased. That means that to a great extent, African-American political and economic influence in the suburbs and in the smaller communities. So I think it's important to look at not only what's happened to cities, but why now African-Americans now have greater influence and a greater presence in some areas that have historically been supermajority white. And as the census comes out, I think you're going to see a greater reflection of how these trends are. Housing being more open, affordable housing being more available in the suburbs. These are the trends of African Americans sort of following the same path that whites followed from the city to suburban communities, sometimes even now back to the South.
Mark Borealis, President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Urban League. His group is just out with its new report, The State of Black America. That report has been published annually since 1976. Mr. Morial was kind enough to join us from a conference in Washington, D.C. that he's attending. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.